Hosea, really, it's an amazing picture. We see the entire book in the first three chapters, essentially illustrated through the marriage of Hosea to Gomer, and then her betrayal of the marriage covenant, her sleeping around on the sly, and eventually leaves him, and eventually is with many other men, and eventually finds herself a sold prostitute, and eventually not even worth anything, and sold as a slave. Yet Hosea just never forgot her. Now, he did have to divorce her, obviously, and God, in a sense, through that illustration, has shown how God had to divorce Israel as well because of their unfaithfulness. And yet he had designs and plans, just like Hosea was led to return to catch her at her lowest point in life. And when no one else wanted her, when she'd all been used up, he went and bought her, his own wife, his one-time wife, and bought her out of the slave market and brought her home and established her again as the privileged wife. And what an amazing story. In a sense, this is the story of God's mercy and love. God is a God of justice, and he must judge sin, but he always devises a plan to show mercy. And you can't get a better picture of that mercy being shown other than the very Son of God, Jesus. God's own arm reached out to us when we were yet sinners, while we were ungodly, didn't want anything to do with God. We wanted to remove God and replace him with ourselves if we could. That's the nature of our flesh. That will be will. I will do what I want to do. I don't care what anybody thinks. And you know what? God mercifully still devised a way to restore us to fellowship with him. Now, the first three chapters, in a sense, sums this up. The rest of the book of Hosea is a compilation of lots of different reasons why he had to discipline, the issues they were facing, and can give us some really good insight into our own walk with God. Are we getting a little bit slack in areas and being hindered in that fellowship with him? And I think it's a great lesson for us, but it's hard to outline because there's so many unrelated thoughts he throws all at once. But I think if I summed up chapters 9 through 11, it would be just the outcome of rebellion. And we can look at this on our own personal level as well. But certainly this picture of marriage that has been given to us. And certainly in our day, marriage is under huge attack. Marriage is something that God instituted. He's the one that established it. It amazes me that anyone would have the arrogance to tinker with that which God is the one that's established. Hey, if the government officials want to give some sort of equal benefits to anybody who wants to marry their dog or a same-sex partner or whatever, great, fine. But to call it marriage, that's the problem. This is a word that the government borrowed, by the way, from God. God is the one that established that. And it amazes me that you have four judges in California that would basically enforce within 30 days' time a rewriting of all of the laws essentially to accommodate same-sex marriage, which is just the beginning of the end for our society, frankly. And then we have the city of Philadelphia. The deadline is there. They've got to toss the Boy Scouts out because the Boy Scouts won't accommodate homosexual partners. And again, you've got an institution that is instrumental in establishing boys that have a solid foundation with integrity and commitment and loyalty and all of those wonderful qualities. And you've got the government officials essentially now forcing that institution, which is based upon God, to get out and not recognizing the value to society that these Boy Scouts have been. I can't even fathom, if remove the Boy Scouts from history. Let's do It's a Wonderful Life, right? Let's do that. Let's remove the Boy Scouts from history. I wonder how many of those boys growing up, not having that model, that foundation, would have become a detriment to society, the crime rate expounded to a degree that we can't even imagine. How many lost opportunities? How many young men aimless and divorced and their kids messed up and the whole volume of evil that would be in this world if it weren't for that amazing institution? You know, I'll tell you, every divorce is a death of a small civilization. Every time we tinker with something that God established, we are only headed down the wrong road. But mind you, all of these things are just a picture of a greater relationship. That relationship is with God and His people. Marriage is a type of Christ and the church. Jesus, who loved us and gave Himself for us. And we, the bride, learning how to submit unto His authority because we know He knows best. And yes, there are going to be some handsome suitors out there luring us away in this world from the Lord Jesus. And they will look tempting and they'll look like, oh, I could have some fun over there. Man, there's so much cool things over there that the Lord doesn't want me to do, you know. Well, of course, you've given Him your heart. Just like in a marriage. It's a betrayal of a marriage vow to, you know, when you say I do, it means you don't to everybody else. And when you break that, you hinder the very foundation of a relationship. And the same thing when it comes to the things of the Lord. So I think it's an important thing. Now, how he starts in chapter 9 is kind of, hey, don't rejoice, he says. O Israel, do not rejoice, O Israel, with joy like other peoples, for you've played the harlot against your God. You've made love for hire in every threshing floor. The threshing floor and the winepress shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail in her. Essentially, Israel literally did make love for hire. They had essentially went on the high places. The threshing floors would be on the tops of hills. And they also became the gathering outposts for those kind of pagan rituals of sexual orgies. Now, at first, it didn't start that way. First, it started with just an alternative way to worship God. And I see today a very interesting parallel with the emerging church movement. You know, you're first just appealing to people where they are. And it starts out well. You know, we want to reach people. Now, I remember back in the hippie days. Certainly, you know, the hippies felt loved to come into the church. And, you know, when the church was responsive to the things of God, they weren't stuffy and they wanted to reach out to these people. They come in their bare feet and their long hair and didn't take a shower for a few days. And you love them. And you know what's amazing? That love of God won over them. But it wasn't like people were trying to figure out how to reach the hippies, become a hippie, and then we can reach the hippies. No. You know, what happened was, actually, Chuck Smith didn't fit the hippie movement at all. If you look at him, he's a man in his 40s, already bald. Didn't try to be a hippie. I can just picture Chuck trying to be a hippie, right? He didn't try. He was himself. He just loved as the Lord gave him. And that reached hippies, and the hippies reached the hippies, because they could relate to the hippies. You know, people wonder about Calvary Chapel, how we're trying to be very clever to reach our generation. I'm just a child of my generation. I'm not trying to be anything. I'm myself. And that's what you should be. When the Lord touches you, you reach out to your generation. But it's a big difference between now orchestrating a movement in which we are now to craftily figure out exactly where the world is. Let's go down there and be that so we can identify with them. So let's go into the bars and, you know, chug one down and then tell them about Jesus. Let's kind of hang around the different places that, you know, would really be a hindrance to our walk with Christ. But, you know, this is the whole mentality. And I think what happens for Israel, it started that way. It started like, hey, let's not be so fussy about going to Jerusalem. Let's worship up here. And eventually they played the harlot. They began to fall in love with idols that, you know, with all the fertility rites in the high places and things, they fell away from their God. You know, it's interesting, even in marriage, you hear a lot more. Have you heard this about emotional affairs and how devastating they can be? If you're in an emotional affair, you think it's no big deal. Oh, we're just good friends. Oh, we like hanging out with each other. Yeah, there's nothing happening. Nothing physical. No touching. No, we're respectful in that regard. But the problem is your heart is following this other person. You're pouring treasure into another woman if you're a guy, or another man if you're a woman, and the treasure you're pouring into, your heart is following. As you begin to talk and tell about your life and your marriage and, you know, your family and this, and you're pouring into this person's listening ear, the more you pour in, the more your heart follows, and then something begins to grip you. You begin to feel that attraction and that attachment, and that affair becomes an emotional one at first. But listen, it always starts there, and then it turns into the action. You see, where you put your treasure, your heart follows. Where you put your heart, eventually your actions will follow. So here's what happened to Israel. Now, essentially, the Lord says, hey, it's no time to party when you should be right with God. Here, don't rejoice. You're going in the wrong direction. That's funny. I remember going to Union Square during the 9/11 disaster. That was where most of the people were congregating there and a few other parks because they were all pushed out from 23rd Street on and above in Manhattan. As they were trying to do the relief effort, all the people that were living down south of 23rd Street were displaced and had to be pushed out. And so there were just thousands of people meandering in this park, candles. It was a memorial that lasted for a couple of weeks. Well, I remember that first week when we were there. We'd been ministering for 11 hours straight. I mean, it's just like constant influx of people, you know, as we're sharing testimonies and singing, doing different things, having different people share their experiences, sharing the gospel, giving out Bibles. And every now and then I'd take a break, go over to the Starbucks, grab a coffee. But I wanted to walk around a little bit of the park to get a feel of a little bit more that was happening. And as I walked a half a block away from the park, I was amazed one evening that the bars were filled. Music playing, drinks flowing, people reveling. And it hit me. I'm amazed. Here we've just had this national disaster. And people are just getting drunk, living it up like there's no tomorrow. Not a time to rejoice. And essentially that's what God is saying. How can you rejoice? You know, because you've betrayed your God. And God's presence has been withdrawn, but they still, the party goes on. They should stop pretending and get real with God. Because essentially what he says is your wine will fail you. Literally, it's an interesting word, fail literally means lie. In other words, he says your wine will lie to you. Your celebration, your pronouncement of freedom and I can do whatever I want is actually a deception. It's lying to you. It's like a farm about to yield a great harvest that doesn't. Or a sweet financial deal ready to pay off and it goes belly up. It won't pay off. It will fail. It's a lie. It's a deception. How I've learned the emptiness of rebellion. I had to learn the hard way my first term in the university. And I thank God it didn't take longer than that. And I bemoan the period of time that I lost in high school. But what a joy coming back to the Lord. So he goes on in verse 3, says, they shall not dwell. Now, he gets a pretty heavy in this pronouncement of judgment. And you've got to understand, he's speaking from the standpoint, really, of a brokenhearted God, because his love for his people is as such. Their betrayal is going to destroy them. And essentially, he's got to turn them over to their own devices. If you have a walk with God and you don't fellowship with the Lord, you don't enjoy it, what's going to happen? Any marriage, just stop working at your marriage. See what happens. What happens to the relationship if you stop trying to be nice, trying to be kind, trying to give to each other, yield to each other? Just don't do anything in a marriage and you'll watch it fall apart very quickly. So he says, they shall not dwell in the Lord's land. But Ephraim shall return to Egypt and shall eat unclean things in Assyria. They shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, nor shall their sacrifices be pleasing to him. It shall be like the bread of mourners to them. All who eat it shall be defiled. For their bread shall be for their own life. It shall not come into the house of the Lord. It's kind of an interesting play here that the bread that they would normally give to the Lord in kind of an offering, they have to actually use to survive. They're just getting by. Instead of even being able to offer to God, they're spending everything on themselves, and it's not enough. He says, what will you do in the appointed day, in the day of the feast of the Lord? In other words, you have nothing to bring. It said, indeed, they are gone because of destruction. Egypt shall gather them up. Memphis shall bury them. Memphis was the capital of Lower Egypt at the time, south of Old Cairo. It says, nettles shall possess their valuables of silver, and thorns shall be in their tents. In other words, they're essentially going to be absorbed by the nations around. They're going to be so devastated by the enemy coming in because they forsook God that they're going to be devastated. In the days of punishment, he says, have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel knows. Now he says, the prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is insane. Now, some commentators have taken this, that all the prophets that were there and all the spiritual men were nuts. Others have said that this is Israel speaking about Hosea and other prophets like him, thinking, you guys are dumb. You don't know what you're talking about. Who would prophesy all of these horrible things in the midst of such joy and prosperity right now? In a sense, you know, it's not unlike our own nation. A couple decades ago, when you had a number of people saying, hey, America, get right, or things are not going to progress well. But instead of turning back to the Lord, more and more we see people not engaging in the culture, not doing what God's called them to do. And essentially we've reaped in our own the fruits of our doings. And now we're in a very tough way. Who knows how bad it will get this summer? I can tell you that as it gets harder and harder, it might get people's attention, but then again, it might not. For Israel, it didn't. But he says the days of punishment have come. He says the watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare in all his ways, enmity in the house of God. Now this, obviously, he is speaking about a false prophet. Here's a prophet that comes up in the days of Jeremiah, especially, they would say, peace, peace, when there was no peace. Nothing worse than that, if you think about that. If you went to the doctor with terminal cancer and he said, oh, no problem, just a little freckle, put a Band-Aid on it, no problem, and you walked out, not knowing that it was eating away your very life and you would be dead soon. There would be nothing worse than that kind of a pronouncement, and yet you would love to hear it, wouldn't you? I mean, that would be great to hear. All right, I'm okay, no problem. Phew, guys, I thought it was cancer. It's just a freckle. No big deal. Love to hear that. And there are a lot of things in the things of ministry that we would love to hear, wouldn't it be? I mean, in fact, I don't particularly care for this part of Hosea, frankly. I like the nice parts of the Bible to share with you and the wonderful experiences that we can have with the Lord. And you know, I don't think if I were going through verse by verse in the Scriptures that I would probably pick out chapter 9 as a passage to share with you. I'd probably avoid it. Nah, I don't like that. It doesn't sound too fun. But you know what? There are things that we don't want to hear. But sometimes we need to hear. And essentially, this is exactly what happened to them. They didn't want to hear the true prophets, so they heaped to themselves the false prophets. Tell us some cool things. Be relevant with us. Be cool with us. And don't be so fussy about truth. Well, he says they are deeply, verse 9, corrupted as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Now, Gibeah, just to give you a little background, all you have to do is write next to Gibeah, Judges chapter 19. Just put J-U-D 19. That'll remind you that's where that should be attached to. So whenever you come back through here, you'll go, Gibeah. Oh, Judges 19. That takes you to a time that was very, very dark in Israel's history. The men of Gibeah actually were militant homosexuals. When visitors would come to town, they'd rape them, essentially. So a couple of visitors came to town and they wanted to rape them. Well, this man actually had a concubine, and he let his concubine go outside, and they raped her and then killed her. Then he cut her body up into 12 pieces, sent it out to the 12 tribes of Israel and said, look at this horrible thing that's been done in Israel. What are you going to do about it? And all the tribes gathered and they went to fight against the men of Gibeah. It was a horrible civil war in the time of Israel because they had gotten so corrupted. They were basically just giving themselves over to any urge that they have. And you know what? Homosexuality, you know, when you start seeing it grow in a culture, it kind of ruins the idea that there's a percentage of people that will always be born homosexuals, because if the numbers are growing, what does that tell you? And it tells you that there is recruitment going on, and that one can be recruited, and that one can learn how to pleasure himself in various ways. So you could easily fall into that. And many people do. And I think what's important to recognize is that once you're given over to that, where pleasure becomes your God, it's hard to see very clearly. You begin to take offense at anyone who would say that you don't have a quote-unquote right to that kind of an experience. But there are consequences to it, and certainly Judges 19 is a great picture of that. Then in verse 10 he says, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as first fruits on the fig tree in the first season, but they went to Baal Peor. Now here he remembers how once fruitful they were. Oh, there would be nothing like finding a grapes in the middle of the wilderness. Out in the middle of nowhere, you're hungry and you find a big old just bounty of grapes. Be a wonderful thing. Fig tree, first season out there. Wonderful experience. My father-in-law has some fig trees, and man, when you pick fresh ripe figs, they're just something else. He says, what happens? He says, they went to Baal Peor. separated themselves to that shame. They became an abomination like the thing they loved. Now, Baal Peor was another incident in Israel's history he's alluding to. And if you want to write next to Baal Peor, Numbers 25. And you'll understand what happened. Now, this is just after the time of Balaam, after Balaam tried to curse Israel. And three times he went up on that hill and it just didn't work out because God wouldn't let him. But Balaam was so determined to get the reward from the king of Moab, and he couldn't curse Israel. He found a way. It's called really the error of Balaam, the mistake he made. He thought that though he couldn't curse Israel, he could get God himself to punish his people if he could incite the people of Israel to sin. You know, this is a very interesting strategy, you see. This should open our eyes to the strategy of the enemy toward us. Here's how it works. You are under the protection of the king, the God of Israel, the creator of the heavens and the earth, the God who created you, the God who is the king of heaven. You are under his protection. Satan cannot touch you. All the demons of hell have no authority over you. Don't think that they have any authority. You might think they do. Maybe you have a bad satanic dream and you're thinking, oh, I've got demons around me. You know, you don't have to worry about it. Because that's all just the lion trying to roar, make you afraid, but he cannot touch you. So his strategy is, he knows he can't touch you, so he is going to incite you to rebel against your father so that your father will discipline you. Because he hates you, he wants you to be punished, he wants you to be messed up. So he's going to throw out a few trinkets, a few little things, pleasures, temptations, lures. Hey, go down this road, this is going to be really cool, man, come on, let's go. And there's all kinds of temptations we all face. And they're all lies. Because if we go down that road, then essentially the doctrine of Balaam worked. That is, he can't touch us, but if he incites us to sin and we willingly choose to sin, then the Lord loves us enough to discipline us. You know, it's amazing how simple principles of wealth are. You know, it's been said, save a tenth, give a tenth, and enjoy the rest. Very simple principle. You do that. Save a tenth, give a tenth, you know, to the Lord, and do the rest with the rest what you will. And you'll be amazed how prosperous you will be over time. If you're doing well already, it would be wiser to even be on a better course. Save a fifth, give a fifth, and enjoy the rest. But I'll tell you what, people, we get into a mentality where it's never enough. So we think we need more. We end up spending not just what we have, but literally our society has made it possible, and this is where Christians are very unwise, especially young people. It's so tempting. They don't even know what it means about debt. They're not afraid of debt. They get all these credit card offers. They go to college, and they start getting these credit cards, and then they think they're really clever because, hey, this one credit card will offer you 0% for a year, so you're going to get this credit card, and then you'll use that to pay off the other credit card. Then you get another credit card to pay off that one. Pretty soon you got 10 credit cards maxed. You're $50,000 to $60,000 in debt because you're buying all these things you want. And man, they say it's okay. It must be okay. I mean, they're letting me do it, right? And then your credit is totally shot. It actually is a shame and a crime, I believe, for the banks to be able to do this. And who knows how that's going to all change, because we're going to see some financial decisions made in this nation I think will be pretty tough. But you see, a believer, I believe honoring the Lord is not going to get into that. Owe no man nothing but to love one another is a principle in the Scriptures. Now, naturally, you know, having a mortgage where you're paying it off and you're within your means is fine. People say you shouldn't even do that. I don't agree with that. But when you start buying stuff on credit, you start buying stuff and you get your credit card, you know, bills up there, it's so foolish. The point is, it's just no self-control. I know this doesn't seem to fit here. I think I'm just using this in the sense of the fact is they were indulging themselves and now they're experiencing the fruit of emptiness. Nothing. Not to mention the very strong warning the Lord puts in front of all those who will go their own way. In Deuteronomy 32:35, he says, in due time their foot will slip. You know, I get a picture of a guy walking on this icy cliff. He's doing pretty good for a while. He's keeping his balance. He keeps going. But you see, in due time, he's going to slip because he shouldn't be there on an icy cliff. And the point is this, it's like we shouldn't be going down a road that we're getting by with it. Getting by with it, it's not a big deal. God doesn't seem to be punishing us. But in due time, your foot will slip. Nothing but God's hand keeps you even in balance anyway. Well, all their wickedness is in Gilgal. For there I hated them. Because of the evil of their deeds, I will drive them from my house. I will love them no more, he says. All their princes are rebellious. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit. Yes, were they to bear children, I would kill the darlings of their womb. Wow. My God will cast them away because they did not obey him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. When you think of what happened to Gomer, essentially it's an interesting picture. This is exactly what happened. Hosea had to at one point let her go. And this is all that came to her as a result. And God is sovereign. It's one thing when we talk about, well, circumstances do this and that to you as a result of your own sin. Sin is its own punishment. That's true. But you see, God is incredibly wise as well. And when we are playing games with him, he is going to deal with us. I look at this and I think, you know, Gilgal was a good illustration because it was once a training place for prophets under Elijah and Elisha. And it was a place where God spoke to them. Now Gilgal became a center of false worship. It's one thing to be weak and stumble in a sin. And we all stumble in so many ways, don't we? That's one thing. We need to encourage one another. That's why small groups are important. You have those accountability partners, people praying for you. You're not isolated. Show me an isolated Christian, I'll show you a huge target for Satan. But when you're together, there's strength in numbers. There's that prayer, that's encouragement, mutual encouragement. You have someone to talk to. You know, I love those mentors I could talk to about my marriage when I was a young man. And I got good counsel. You know, it was really cool because we had a couple that Karen and I both agreed. No matter what we do in our marriage, we give each other permission to talk to that couple about it. Like I talked to the guy and she talked to the woman. So I knew that whatever I was doing as a husband, she would rat on me to this woman. And we made our decision up ahead of time. And I think that's important. How many couples, you know, no way, you don't tell anybody, you know, loyalty. It's just going to be us. We'll kill each other, but it's a circle of trust. No, I mean, having somebody else in the mix is wonderful. It's wise. Plus, it kept me from being a real jerk, you know, I think at times, knowing if I do that, she's going to go tell her, I don't want to be embarrassed. You know what? That's healthy. It's healthy to walk in the light. I mean, it's the same thing with leaders here in the church. Do you know what I mean? I tell the leaders, look, if you ever think that I'm doing anything like unseemly as a pastor, or things that you question, or maybe doctor, or whatever it is, you have my permission ahead of time to go to my elders. Not the elders here. The elders here are the elders of the church. But my elders are like, you know, Chuck Smith and Raul Reese and Don McClure and guys like this that they'll come and say, what are you doing? They'll put me to task. They can call me to the carpet. That's healthy. I don't have nothing to hide, so I invite that. And you don't need my permission to go to them. You can write them, call them anytime if you sense that I'm not in the right path. And you know why? Because I think there's a healthy accountability. And when people don't have that, when they're isolated, they're a danger to themselves and others. And I think this is what happened with Israel. They had gotten so far off. You know, Gilgal, see, it's one thing, like I was making the point, there's one thing to stumble in a weakness, but it's quite another thing to make that a religion. In other words, to make that itself, give it the mantle of purity and holiness and good. And what I see in the emerging church movement scares me because it's like giving a mantle of approval of spirituality to ungodliness in some ways. I think it's dangerous. So I think this is where that Gilgal had become, once a place where God met them, now become a place of false worship. And so now we get to a little bit of the lament in chapter 10 here, and we'll be finishing up with this, but it ties in very well. Israel empties his vine. He brings forth fruit for himself. According to the multitude of his fruit, he has increased the altars. Notice the progression. He's taking that fruit for himself. He's spending it all on him. And now, because of that fruit, he's actually increased the false ways of worship in his life. According to the bounty of his land, they've embellished his sacred pillars. Their heart is divided. You know, it's true, you can't serve the world and God. You can't serve God and mammon, Jesus said. You're going to love the one and hate the other. No man can have two masters. When you use the blessing, and this is what they did, they were blessed by God in that land, most beautiful land, and they used it for themselves. And so the Lord had to basically throw them out of the land. You know, I think what makes a good marriage a good marriage is instead of thinking of yourself, you learn how, and actually you delight in, pleasing your partner. Going out of your way to make your partner happy. Most of the time when you get in arguments, right, you feel like they're not thinking of you. They're selfish, right? They've thought of themselves. They're not really putting you first. And, you know, you got to fight for your rights and you have an argument. But when you get to that maturity where you're thinking, you know, you're trying to outdo one another in love. You're trying to outdo and think of the other before they can think of you. It's wonderful. There's nothing like that. It doesn't exist normal in the world. It takes a choice. But when your heart is divided between pleasing self and pleasing God, then that's when things start falling down. This is why when you look at the Sermon on the Mount, in fact, I actually happened to catch myself on the radio this morning, and it wasn't so much myself as it was listening again to those things that when I was going through the Sermon on the Mount, especially in regard to turning the other cheek, give to those who ask of you, you know, if someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them too. Those things that go, they're so much against the nature of ourself. And it does not fit anyone except a believer. But a believer is even challenged to realize you will be free from the tyranny of self when you love. And when you fear, and you're afraid to give because you're afraid someone will take advantage of you, and you're afraid to do the right thing because you don't want to be thought of as weak and be manipulated, you're in bondage. It's a paradox. You give it away and you discover life. Oh, the freedom that there is in being filled with the Lord and following Him. But when you spend it on yourself, what an emptiness. He says in verse 3, "For now they say we have no king. Because we did not fear the Lord, as for a king, what would He do for us? They've spoken words, swearing falsely, making a covenant. Thus judgment springs up then like hemlock in the furrows of the field." You know, I think of how poison hemlock would grow up among the plants, just very slowly, subtly. You wouldn't notice it. You reap some of that fruit, chop it up, put it in your soup, and then you die. You didn't notice it. And so much poison is being mixed in, I believe, even with the poisonous ideas. You know, I watched a young man, and it's heartbreaking because it's someone very close to home. I watched a young man who wanted to please himself, and in trying to break away from any constraints of the religion that he had been brought up with, had to find some philosophy to cut those connections with God and the Bible. And he found a very handy philosophy, Nietzsche. Began to read and devour this book, Beyond Good and Evil. Began to really just dig into this whole idea that there is no real truth. There's no real absolute truth. Now this postmodernism, of course, really, if you think about it, it's self-defeating. Because when someone comes up to you and says there are no absolute truths, all you have to do is say, "Are you absolutely sure?" The very fact you're saying that is you're saying there's an absolute truth. How do you know that's not true? Because you're saying that's true, and there are no absolute truths, you can't convey that that's true. The point is, it led him to just confusion of mind. And it reminded me in Deuteronomy 28, one of the curses that would come upon Israel when they would rebel against God, He would bring them into confusion of mind. And I believe there's a lot of people today in confusion of mind. And they don't know what's going on. The hemlock's growing up, and it's poisoning them, and they can't see it. The inhabitants of Samaria fear because of the calf of Beth Avon, for its people mourn for it, and its priests shriek for it, because its glory has departed from it. And the idol shall be carried to Assyria as a present for King Jerob. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel. Remember, Ephraim is just another word or name for Israel. One of the big tribes in Israel was very notable. But all of this is saying is that all of these places, they're going to be driven out from Israel. They're all going to be passing the gods around. At the end of the day, it's all empty. He says, "The high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, shall be destroyed. The thorn and the thistle shall grow on their altars, And they'll say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Now, it's interesting that this phrase later on is used in Revelation. And the pain that comes to a person when they hide from God, when they run from God, eventually that gaze of God is terrifying to them. They can't endure it. They will do anything to cover themselves up. And here you have this very phrase being used in this context in which they're so confused now. They're being scattered through the nations. And now they have no covering. He says, verse 9, O Israel, you've sinned from the days of Gibeah. There they stood. The battle in Gibeah against the children of iniquity did not overtake them. See, at least in Gibeah, remember in Judges 19, at least there, Gibeah was defeated. And they were soundly defeated. And the nation had some semblance of right and wrong. But here, what he's saying is that, you know, the battle of Gibeah against the children of iniquity did not overtake them. In other words, you guys are so bad that it's not working out bad for you. He says, but when it is my desire, I will chasten them. People shall be gathered against them when I bind them for their two transgressions. Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh grain, but I harnessed her fair neck. I'll make Ephraim pull a plow. Judah shall plow. Jacob shall break his clots. You know, it's kind of an interesting pastoral theme here. You know, Ephraim, essentially so proud, doesn't realize what's happening is that all of the training she's receiving now, she's just pulling this plow. Beautiful heifer, beautiful. They worship the calf, right? So it's a play on that. The Lord reminds them, you know, okay, you're a beautiful cow. Now I'm going to put a harness on you. And you're going to pull a plow. And you're going to break clods. I could tell you honestly, in my own life, all of my philosophies became a yoke. And all I could end up doing with my life is breaking clods. Depressed, insecure, frustrated, breaking clods. All of my glory, all of what I thought I was going to be. And God had to humble me. I wouldn't trade that for anything. I look back at those days of how he had to humble me, just like he had to humble Ephraim. But this is the point. This is the response he's looking for. He says, sow for yourselves righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord till he comes and rains righteousness on you. He turns that around and uses the emblem of the plow and essentially says, okay, sow for yourselves righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground. One of the most important steps, I believe, as a Christian is your fallow ground. That's ground that's just left alone. You haven't tended to it. You just let it go. It's like a wild ground. Anything grows on it. It's a hardened path, trampled down. What do you have to do in order to plant something? You've got to prepare that soil. So you've got to put the furrows through it, the plow through it, making the furrows, upturning all of that fallow ground. And you know, frankly, if your heart was the fallow ground, it's a painful process, right? David cries, you know, your furrows have up and down my back in the Psalms. Not a pleasant picture. And I can think of those painful experiences in my life that helped me just humble myself before the Lord so the Lord would break me up a little bit so he could plant some good seed in there. Otherwise, it wouldn't be planted. So break up your fallow ground, for it's time to seek the Lord till he comes and rains righteousness on you. It's a beautiful passage. I'd hope this is one passage out of the whole book of Hosea that you'd memorize. Hosea 10:12. I one time, just for fun, I was at a friend's house in California, and they have those little message boards by the phone, and I was just standing there. I started doodling, Hosea 10:12, and I just left it up there, forgot about it. 3 weeks later, I get a call from them and says, did you write Hosea 10:12 on the board? I go, oh, yeah, that was me. I forgot all about that. I'm sorry. They said, you have no idea what you did to us. We didn't know where that came from. We looked it up and we thought, is God trying to speak to us? We got on our knees, we're seeking the Lord, and we're like wondering, well, who put that there? And who's thinking maybe we're not doing so well? And it was like they're going through all this stuff, but they said, you know what? It had a great effect. We began really just praying and seeking the Lord. And then it just came upon us that you were here that one day, and you thought you might have done it, and sure enough, you did. And I thought, wow, I think I'm going to do that more often to people. It's a good passage. glimmer of hope is given here. You see it? He wants to rain righteousness on you. He wants to bless you. But you know, he says, you've got to break up your fallow ground. Now, he says, you've plowed wickedness, you've reaped iniquity, you've eaten fruits of lies because you trusted in your own way, in the multitude of your mighty men. Therefore, tumult shall arise among your people, all your fortresses shall be plundered, as Shalman plundered Beth Araba in the day of battle. And by the way, this is not really a reference that we have any understanding of. He says, a mother dashed in pieces upon her children. It's a horrible time, apparently. He says, thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be cut off utterly. And then Israel, he says, when Israel was a child, I loved him. I don't want you to miss this part of this, because I want you to see how God in his discipline is thinking of them, just like Hosea, thinking of Gomer, even when she was way out there. He says, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. God's recalling when he first brought the nation out of Egypt. It's also used as messianic when Jesus went down to Egypt for a time, and the Lord then brought him back. And as they called him, so they went from them. They sacrificed to the Baals and burned incense to carved images. I taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I drew them. Listen, this is God speaking to you. I drew them with gentle cords, with bands of love. And I was to them as those who take the yoke from their neck. I stooped and fed them. By the way, and that's a good illustration, Satan drives you, but the Lord leads you. He's the shepherd. He says, he shall not return to the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be his king because they refuse to repent. And the sword shall slash in his cities, devour his districts, and consume them because of their own counsels. My people are bent on backsliding from me. Though they call to me the Most High, none at all exalt me. Here they've got just lip service going on. Empty profession. He says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? Look at, listen to the heart of God. How can I give you up? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I make you like Admah and set you like Zeboim? My heart churns within me. My sympathy is stirred. By the way, interesting, Admah and Zeboim were two towns nearby Sodom and Gomorrah that got destroyed in the mix as well. And it's a good illustration that God was judging Sodom and Gomorrah, but two towns nearby, also corrupted, were also destroyed. And it's an interesting illustration that he uses for those that he doesn't want to make them like Admah. He doesn't want them to be near the people he's going to judge. But sadly, Admah and Zeboim were judged. But look, notice he says, my heart churns within me. My sympathy is stirred. I will not execute the fierceness of my anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come with terror. Notice the Lord's commitment. This reminds me of when Hosea was encouraged to go back. At the lowest point of her experience, he rescued her. He does that to many people. Sometimes he has to let you eat the fruit of your ways till you get tired of the pig slop like the prodigal son. Because he loves you. He loves you. If you were happy eating pig slop, if you were quite content, your end would be permanent ruin. But your discomfort in the pig slop is a good thing so that you'll come back to him. He says, they shall walk after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, then his son shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like a bird from Egypt, like a dove from the land of Assyria. And I will let them dwell in their houses, says the Lord. But I love how this ends in this one context. This is God's commitment. This is God's commitment. And how much he loves us, even when we're knuckleheads. Even when we're stubborn. Now, he's faithful to challenge us and to discipline us when necessary, because he is our Father in heaven. And I'm so glad that he does.